Hillary going to the Senate and talking about price gouging. There's her making a joke about getting a sample of her hair.
Oh, that's his joke. Yeah, that's how he lost his bail. Yeah, that was okay. If you're ever on bail, just don't
call Hillary.
Don't even jokingly threaten people. Like, just don't do it.
Sure.
Don't.
Welcome to another episode of the Bored with Nelly podcast. Today, I'm joined with Christy Smite. Did I say that right?
Smite, yeah.
Yes. She is a journalist from New York who is most known for her serialized memoir talking about her relationship with infamous pharma bro Martin Shkreli, also commonly mispronounced, I think I'm good with both of those. Okay. You can also see her in the 2021 documentary Pharma Bro made by Brent Hodge. Thank you so much for being a guest.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is a fascinating story. This whole Shkreli thing, your writing, which I've listened to quite a bit on Substack, there's so many levels and so many interesting things going on here. So first of all, Shkreli was what, a person that took a drug and raised the price?
Yeah, I mean,
500%.
Yeah, which is wild and deserved, you know, some infamy. But then, you know, what has been interesting is the media circus and the social media circus surrounding him since that happened. And I was part of the media circus. Like, before I got to know Martin as a person, I was a legal reporter at Bloomberg, and I actually broke the story of his arrest on securities fraud charges. Because, you know, he was like, I latched onto that story because I'm like, oh, wow, he's really super infamous. And I know that there's a securities fraud investigation going on into him. This is going to be big news. I need to break this. And then I did. And it was an explosive story. It was the most read story published by the entirety of Bloomberg for all of 2015. The weirdest thing after that is Martin started to talk to me. And the reason why, I wanted to write a book about him initially because we had like a good rapport, and I'm a writer, I'm a journalist, and I'm interested in him as a character. And then so much happened in life and his life and my life. And it, you know, sprung out over the course of like 2 years that like we developed a friendship. And by the time he went to prison, like, it turned like romantic. Like, I really, really cared about him.
Right.
And everyone was so afraid of me developing feelings for him, becoming too close to him. And it was like so weird as just like being like an educated woman, having someone tell you like, oh no, that man's going to hurt you or something like that. Like, that's ridiculous. He is a dysfunctional person. I get that. but like the idea that like somehow like,
we're all a little dysfunctional.
Exactly.
Aren't we, though?
Exactly.
We're all a little bit fucked.
Yeah. I mean, he's more so. I mean,
sure.
I'm
agreeing with you and also disagreeing with this at the same time.
That's cool. But anyway, like at a certain point, you know, the pandemic happened when he's in prison. We are like dating when he's in prison. You know, I quit my job. I had been married. I left an ex-husband because I was not happy. And then I had to go public with the story because I was at my wit's end. I was really worried about him, like about his health and about his ability to get help because he was so hated. Like, the American prison system is terrible and access to healthcare is also terrible. So I was so worried about it. I just like went with my instincts and just, you know, did like someone, I let a reporter I knew do a big profile of me in Elle magazine. And he hated it. He did not want me doing that. I was like, look, you know, I know better than you. I don't want to be right and you to get sick and there to be no one to stand up for you.
Like, right. Yeah.
So anyway, that's all in a nutshell. And I wanted to write a book because it is such a crazy experience. And I have always been interested in the story, obviously. Now I'm part of the story. And I needed to tell it. I needed to tell it as a memoir.
It's very unique. I liked, that's why I enjoyed listening. I mean, I didn't have time to read it. I just listened to most of the Stubstack stuff. And I really enjoyed listening to, like, as funny as it is to say to you, it's like you as the character in the story, that's when it got even more interesting for me. Like when I really became fully involved was like when you start going to prison and like you start talking to girls at the prison who are also visiting cons and stuff. I'm like, this is such a good, like a show almost. Like this is life, but this could be turned into a movie almost.
It is it's a wild experience when you get that slice of life. And for me, it was very shocking. Like it turned me a bit into a criminal justice reform advocate because.
Right. You saw the inner workings firsthand.
Yeah. I mean, before I had just been, you have to understand, like it's a complete different perspective. When you're a reporter working for a big news organization, I mean, you know what's going on, like on a surface level, but you don't really feel it. Like you kind of push all those feelings away and you're just working on the headline or whatever. And then when you see it and you see the people who are affected by the system, it's horrible. I mean, I can still remember the first time I saw Martin. I was visiting him when he was in solitary and they take you in a little room. Like you have to like, you know, it's through a glass, like visiting it, like the maximum security possible is there for you and you're in solitary. So you have to be let in handcuffs and all that. Wow. And to see him in handcuffs, Martin Shkreli, a skinny guy who represents zero physical threat to anybody. and the absurdity of it and also the dehumanization of it. I mean, it's a small thing, but it really hits you.
Yeah. Actually, right before you, I had a gentleman who was, he did 7 years in solitary confinement. So I really I got to learn quite a bit about the system and, you know, the horrendous things that go behind, you know, what no one talks about, I guess.
The mental strength that it takes is.
Yeah, you have to, it's hard for me to understand. It's like he was talking a different language at one point. This is a story. This is why there's so many levels to this. And maybe there's like a, this is kind of a refresher for some people because there's so many new things and cultural shifts that happened during this time. So one of them was, I think he was one of the first really big public figures to get that internet mob on him, that huge Twitter dogpiling on him, right? Or is that wrong?
I think you're right. I think it set the tone for how that would proceed in further situations. Like and also remember, like nobody really knew who he was outside of like hedge funds and pharma before he became this infamous figure. And through that infamy, he became famous. So basically he became famous for being hated.
And he became a famous villain. He became the most hated person in America.
Yeah, yeah. And it was really interesting. I did a little look back through his you know, when he used to have Twitter because he was banned from Twitter. He had, you know, I think about 4,000 or 5,000 Twitter followers before the price increase. After the Daraprim price increase, because he was, you know, instantaneously infamous, he had like 12 or 13,000 followers. And then basically based purely on his own antics and ridiculousness, he ballooned that following to 184,000 in the next year and a half.
Whoa.
So people are like, oh, you're famous for raising the drug price. I'm like, no. He's famous for being infamous. He's just good at that.
That's the stuff of dreams for like PR teams. That's like the stuff they'll talk about at the water cooler. Like, can you believe they grew their social media that much in like a year?
Yeah, it's
and
so
he did
weird.
It without almost trying, just being himself.
Yeah, exactly. It is the stuff of dreams. And I do think that some of the media spite towards him is a little bit of jealousy, right?
Sure. Like people took notes for sure. They took notes of what he was doing and they started implementing probably some of it in their own strategies, like absorbing the villain role, you know, they definitely took some, you know, takeaways from that.
Yeah. I mean, just the way that he would interact with the media and I'm not there. There certainly when he would talk to women journalists, it could be really awful and sexist. But in general, he was awful to all journalists. And the way he would could talk to some like kind of arrogant male journalists and kind of throw them off their game, I actually really enjoyed. So
it's funny. It's really, this is the thing. I don't know who's running his Instagram. Have you seen his Instagram?
I haven't been paying much attention to his Instagram or what he's doing currently online.
Pure content. It's actually hilarious. Like the understanding of memes and internet culture. I don't know if it's some random person running it for him, but it's actually like really funny.
It's probably him.
It might be him, right?
I don't think that, I mean, he loves doing that stuff.
Like he had a video where he was basically like showing off a watch that he had in prison. It was like an eBay style, like I'm selling this watch, and then I'd like Price is Right music, and I'm like, why didn't this guy go into like maybe comedy or something? Because they're like, he's definitely funny.
Yeah, he's very funny.
So that's only one element of this story. So this was just like, I'm opening this thing up a little bit. So the massive internet hate mob, one of the first of its kind. We have him buying a Wu-Tang album that no one's listened to for $2 million. That was a big headline story. There was a lot of talk about that.
Yeah.
There's Hillary going to the Senate and talking about price gouging. There's her making a joke about getting a sample of her hair.
Oh, that's his joke. Yeah, that's how he lost his bail. Yeah, that was okay. If you're ever on bail, just don't
call Hillary.
Don't even jokingly threaten people. Like, just don't do it.
Even if it's funny and clever, don't do it.
Just don't.
Then we have COVID in prison, which was like a very scary and crazy time where we were all uncertain what was going on, safety of people, you know, that you care about in prison, let's say. Then we have an opportunity there for him to get some sort of redemption to work on, like there was talks of him working on some sort of, you know, cure or whatever, vaccine. When someone asks you, I guess this is the bigger question, okay, tell me about this story. Where do you even start? Where do you usually start?
So I mean, I usually start babbling, but I really do think that the story at its heart is about cancel culture. I mean, that is what it is. And whether you agree with that being a thing or not, or whether that being a problem or not, the whole way society has just riled up around a person and tried to expunge them in every way possible is definitely what happened.
Yeah, 100%.
So it's pretty hard to argue with the evidence that this is cancellation happening. And I think it's what makes it more interesting is, you know, when I stood up and I'm like, I was his girlfriend. And I'm like this, you know, I was a respected journalist and all that stuff. I mean, I did a prestigious fellowship at Columbia University. I challenged that and people didn't like it. They didn't, cause you know, then they had to like try to cancel me too. Cause it didn't fit. Right. So you had people like, at first you had people in the media, like calling me crazy. And it was like, are you serious? You're a feminist writer and you totally understand that people have been calling women crazy to write them off for centuries. Like what?
Right. Everyone's a big hypocrite. Society is just like riddled with hypocrisy. It's so glaring and obvious nowadays that it's like sickening.
It's sickening. Yeah. So it was like, I kind of found the line, like, you know, sometimes you have to challenge something and you have to like stick yourself out there to kind of like see the stuff people don't want to talk about or like make it come out. And so I kind of did that. Like when I went public in Owl, like it was like the internet was just like, ah.
What did you think you could provide by doing that? Did you believe like you could provide an alternative side to the story that was so one-sided?
It was actually, I mean, a bit, yes, to an extent, but on a more like mechanical level, I really believe that, the only way that he could get help, like the prosecutors were going to fight no matter what, because I saw what they said when he made that his application for release. I expected them to oppose it. They went way overboard. Like they were like, they wanted to smash him to the ground. And I was like, you know, these are people I knew. I covered Brooklyn Federal Court. I was on a first name basis with these people. During the trial, you know, I considered what they did to be pretty fair for the most part as prosecutors. And then they just went way overboard with this, when he was requesting release, and I was like, you know what? The only thing I can do, the only thing that will make a difference to public figures is if I make it messy. Basically, I have to make it optically messy. And that, like, I had to be an obstacle. I had to, because, like, if it's not hard to do, if there isn't blowback in the press or social media or somebody fighting with you publicly, then they'll just do it, right? Like, they'll just do what they want.
Sure, yeah.
So I really, and, like, it kind of reminded me, I did a smirk post recently comparing this whole thing to Tom Wolfe's The Bonfire of the Vanities. It really reminded me of that in parts of the whole situation.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that. Can you
tell me? Look, you know, it was written in, like, 1987. It's a terrible movie. Do not watch the movie. It is the most ridiculously miscast movie ever. Like, Tom Hanks. Yeah, because they threw all these, like, 80s stars in it. Like, Tom Hanks is the main character. Doesn't work. Tom Hanks is a very likable guy. The main character of Bonfire of the Vanities is an asshole. So, like, but anyway, it's basically about, like, a proto cancel culture, like this. New York in the '80s, very gritty, crime ridden, lots of poverty, lots of racial inequality, bad. You have the main character. Everyone in the book is a bad person. Almost everyone. The main character is this bond trader who's, like, rich and greedy, and, you know, he's amoral, he has a mistress, you know, he's lying to everybody. And he,
like, a Gordon Gekko kind of guy? Like,
not quite. Like he wants to be Gordon Gekko, but he's not.
Okay. That makes it kind of funnier, but yeah, okay.
Yeah. But then he, like, gets into an accident in the Bronx with his mistress. His mistress is actually driving the car, and she hits a young black man, a black teenager, and kills him. And this sets up a huge explosion of media and, like, everything. Like, he becomes, like, he becomes the suspect for killing this teenager. And of course it's, like, you know, class and race and all these things. The whole city rises up against him, basically. So a lot of that, there was a lot of factors there, and all the public servants are in it for themselves. Like, nobody's trying to fix the broken justice system.
Sure. They're all trying to fix their own, or they're doing it for themselves.
They're all trying to, like, serve this white traitor guy on a platter because, you know, it's the one thing they can do. And the journalists in the story are terrible too. Like, they spread lies and misstatements just so they can, like, hype things up and make people more angry.
Okay. I see now the similarities here.
Yeah.
So the little bit, I guess, the technical part of the story. So he takes this drug that's commonly used and he increases the price 500%, not illegal, but, you know, in America at least, and still not illegal in America, by the way. So that's, I kind of, that needs to be said because there's a lot of this, like, you know, internet rage, commotion about this, but the problem did not get fixed at all, right?
The problem has been going on for a long time. The problem is much bigger than him.
He's just the guy, perfect for them.
He just became the human meme because he was, like, the easiest version to pack the facts into, and there's a face to go with it. But there's so much worse that happens throughout the industry. And, like, that doesn't excuse anything, but it is, like, well, why are you so angry at this one guy? You should be fixing the system, you know?
Because it's hard to be angry at a corporation sometimes. It's much easier to be angry at a human. And I guess when he does eventually go to jail or whatever, you know, gets a 7-year sentence or what? It was a 7?
Yeah, but it was also, that was not for the price increase.
That, it was for right, it was from completely different, right? What did he actually go to jail for?
He went to jail for, so Martin started off poor, basically. I mean, he was the son of janitors from Albania and Montenegro. And he was trying really hard to be successful. He was a really precocious, smart kid. And he was, like, doing his best to, like, you know, hustle his way into success. And so he did some, you know, cut some corners. He lied to some investors, which is illegal, in order to persuade them to invest with him. Then, because he took stupid risks, he lost their money. And then, even though he probably could have walked away then without any real consequences, he started a drug company called Retrofin, and it actually succeeded. and he was able to pay his investors. Like, he treated those initial hedge fund investors as investors in Retrofin or as consultants. And he found ways to pay them using Retrofin and kind of justified it all in his head by saying, well, you know, they're investing with me and this is part of their investment.
Right.
But, you know, parts of that are definitely illegal. That's what he...
Right. Okay. But, like, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense a little
bit. I'm laughing because he didn't leave a trail of widows and orphans or people who were impoverished. In fact, some people made millions of dollars through him. It was frustrating for them because he would go dark and not tell them what was going on with their money because he lost it. But then in the end, they all ended up better off. Not the way you should do business. Definitely crossed the line of fraud, and that's what he went to prison for.
Right. Let's talk about the drug price and the morality behind it, because that's always an interesting conversation. What he did was immoral, right? Is that that's fair to say?
I would call it amoral.
Amoral. Why would you call it amoral?
Because I don't think he was trying to hurt people.
That's something I did want to ask. Sorry to interrupt you. When he says, like, he wanted to take some of the proceeds and, you know, make the drug better, and he was going to pay for anyone that couldn't afford it, anyone that was uninsured, you genuinely believe he meant that?
I do. And there was proof that he did do that.
There's proof. Yeah. In what? How so? Like, what's the...
Did you watch Brent's documentary?
I did, but I don't... There was a lot of, like, gray areas with some of the people. I know there was one guy that he paid for on Reddit, but it seems like there's a lot of gray area with who he helped and who he didn't help. Was anyone, you know, seriously hurt? Did someone die from not being able to get the drug? Stuff like that.
The only stories that have come out of anyone dying for not being able to get the drug are, I think, there was one story that came up in the FTC case, and I think we would reasonably trust government investigators out to get Martin Shkreli to find who died from not getting Daraprim. And that person actually died because they got a horrible hospital infection and because they had to be kept at the hospital in order to access Daraprim. They wouldn't be able to afford it. Like, the way it was set up was he could get it in the hospital, but he couldn't get it not in the hospital. So, like, he ended up getting a hospital-borne infection not related to that because he was in the hospital for so long.
And that's only one case.
One case. And then there was another case. I don't know the details of it, but a doctor wrote a letter to the judge when Martin was sentenced, referring to someone else dying for not being able to get Daraprim. But she never put the letter on record. I have no idea, like, what the details of the story are.
It's fascinating because you have this massive mob and they're all righteous and talking about people are dying from this. You're taking away lives essentially. And then you ask yourself, well, if that's the case, where are these vocal people? If I'm on a deathbed and this person is what's holding me back from getting my medication, I would take the biggest speaker I have and I would blow this thing out of the water. So how is that possible that no one did that?
It's because people found a way to get the drug to them or they found an alternative. I mean, I don't want to say I agree with any of this. I don't.
Sure.
It's just I don't agree with the reaction.
Right. It's an interesting case because it puts your own morals into questions and it really, like, kind of tippy toes that line of your own probably morality or some sort of person that's listening to this, their own morality. It's like, did he ultimately just want to take a lot of insurance money because he knew his insurance company would pay? And if that's the case, I mean, we're talking about Robin Hood shit at that point, right? Like, that's kind of like, if you're thinking of evil corporations, pharma and, you know, insurance is up there in my, like, you know, ladder. Yeah. And if he wants to fuck them, like, that's fantastic.
Yeah, if he were better at PR, he probably would have cast it that way, but he's not. So
why didn't he cast it that way? Yeah, well, I guess if you start messing around with people with that kind of money, that's a different level, a threat level, in my opinion. Like, you don't just start going after multi-trillion dollar organizations.
Oh yeah, for sure. But yeah, it's that's what the whole play is, you know. And again, I don't agree with it, but it's and this has been going on in rare disease markets for quite some time. You know, you have a drug that is the only real treatment for a particular condition. So you know, rationally insurance companies should have to pay for it. And then you jack the price, and at least the sticker price, and then, you know, you get the insurance money, and then, you know, if patients can't afford to get it, you find some side deal or something like that so they can get it.
Is this in a kind of a, I mean, maybe this is a terrible comparison, but it's kind of like shorting a stock almost. Like, it's a little bit kind of, maybe not immoral, definitely not immoral, but there's some sort of like grayish area. You're kind of hoping for a company to fail and you're making money from it, where it's like you're hoping that these insurance companies will fucking pay whatever the price is of this drug that you've raised.
Yeah, I mean, it's shorting, I think, is less bad than, you know, than trying to extort insurance companies. But
in the Wall Street world, though, like, all of these things are like fair game. Like,
Warren was a short seller, so that was the thing. In fact, he actually did hilariously after he failed at his hedge funds. He managed to make tens of millions of dollars himself when he traded for himself on some shorts. So he does know, and his calls were usually in the right direction. It just wasn't always the right time. It's a very risky thing to do, especially if you like start, you know, borrowing money on margin to.
So he can he has the ability to make money and be unseen. He has the ability to just be on his computer somewhere and probably be well off. But he's chosen this route of, you know, let's become the CEO of a company. Let's do all this crazy shit. And then once like the mob comes in, let's entertain them. Let's bring them all on.
I'm not saying that's a normal reaction. But I don't agree with all of his trolling. And I think he can go way over the line sometimes.
Right.
But he has this, just this like joy in him that comes from, you know, poking people behind facades and like getting them to kind of like, you know, just forcing them to like out of their image consciousness or whatever. And I like that. I like doing that too, except, you know, maybe less in a less evil way.
Right. So when you were with him, were there like ever times where he would like, he show you like a tweet or something or whatever, a headline, and then like he's trying to scheme a good reply to this, and he's telling you like good bit ideas.
He has.
Really? He's like, I got this really funny joke. Do you think this meme is appropriate, or do you like this meme better? Which one do you like?
He definitely doesn't care about appropriate, but
which one's funnier? He's probably like, which one's funnier? Which meme is more like offensive?
Like, you know, or like which one is going to get more people to react in a particular? Yeah, it's more than just memes. It's more like full on bits. Like,
wow.
Like, what kind of, like, ridiculous constructed narrative can I come up with that will make the media write headlines as though it's real, even though it's not?
Yeah. That's so funny. That's, like, I just picture him in his bed, like, oh, that's not funny. That's not funny. Oh, that's good. That's a good one. They'll fucking love this one. He just posts it, and he gets excited about it.
It's possible.
So your story in this, where did the love come from? Because that's a big word. And I'd like to know how that happened. What's the timeline here?
Well, okay. So this took a while, because remember, first there, I was in a completely different state. You know, I was married. I was a journalist writing about him. You don't do that stuff when you're a journalist, you know, writing. You can't just like date someone you're covering.
Participate journalism or whatever.
Yeah, you can't do that when you like work for Bloomberg. I'm well aware of that. I quit because I was feeling feelings and I didn't know what to do with them. Right. So like, it was conflicting and I needed to go. That was my decision. Love, I think, came over, it's twofold. One, I think we just connect really well, you know, mentally, like we just get each other.
Sure.
And that's a very refreshing thing, especially if you like
are
a weird nerd and you go through life not being understood.
Of course.
Yeah. And then, you know, and I think there was some mutual admiration there. You know, he's always admired my writing, genuinely, like, you know, he's not faking it. He'll read it, respond to it. And
you said he was one of the first people to like respond to your stuff and really kind of, you know, start talking to you. Why do you think that originally happened?
Oh, I know why it happened. So when I first wrote, before he was infamous, when I first wrote about his securities fraud investigation, as that was starting, that was, you know, a year before, I wrote a story about it. I found out about it, wrote a story about it. And he called me at first and I thought he was lying. He was like, basically like, what are you writing the story for? This isn't real. Like, what are you talking about? Like, just arguing with me. And I'm like, no, I know it's real. Like, my sourcing is pretty solid. I know what I'm talking about. And I'm like, you should know too. Like, at this point.
Wait, it was about him getting investigated, right?
Yeah. I'm like,
he should know about that.
I'm like, there's a lot of indications that this could be happening. So I went ahead and published the story. And then later on, after he was arrested, when he called me, he hung on to my phone number for, you know, a year or whatever, called me back and was like, you were right.
He's in his prison. He's in his jail. He's like, you were right.
Well, no, I mean, he was, you know, he's back home then, but
yeah, I'm trolling.
Yeah, no, it's, it's just like, you're right. I should have listened to you.
So yeah, that's what, okay. Let's go back to the love question. Where did it, you were saying there was a second part to it.
Yeah, I think, friendship came easily. That was not hard, actually. It was frustrating. I mean, then also there was like kind of the annoyance of like, you know, when he would be kind of shitty to me for no reason. And then I would be like, find some way to get back at him. And there was like this kind of like little sparring thing going on for a little while. And then when he went to prison, when he was thrown in prison, that was a huge shock to my system. And I think that that's where the love started, was when I was like, or realizing it was there or like coming out because of the intensity of the circumstance, right? Like,
because you thought like maybe you're not going to see him for a while. That's when you like started.
No, it was more than that. It was when when he lost his bail, the internet like erupted into prison rape jokes.
Jesus. And,
I mean, and even like some of the reporters I was like working with like made prison rape jokes on Twitter, and I was like, oh my God, what is this?
Yeah. How can you guys like be upset about this guy saying horrendous shit and then you're okay with your own horrendous shit that you're saying? It's like, anyways, the hypocrisy.
So I was so worried about his safety and also angry at him for putting himself in that situation. It was a completely a choice on his part to
avoidable, very avoidable.
So I actually, you can see it. It's actually documentable. I was wearing a Fitbit at the time, and you can see right after he was thrown in prison for a whole week, my resting heart rate was 10 beats higher.
Whoa. You were genuinely worried. Yeah. Makes sense.
And I like wrote I was up all night after he was thrown in. My ex-husband was not happy about that. And, I knew that he would, there's an email system in prison, which I was aware of. So I wanted to send him my email address, but I also, I scrawled it in a handwritten letter and I said, I told you so.
You're really enjoying yourself that time.
And he waited about a week before he finally emailed me. And then I get this like email from Cora Langs that's just like, hey. And so we have these like, this conversation is like, two word conversations going back. Did you get your books? Yes. Did you get your mail? Yes.
My God.
He's just clearly sullen and childish. And,
sure.
I'm kind of like worried. And, so that's kind of where that started. And then he told me later on that he waited a while to send me an email cause he was pissed at me for telling him I told you so. But then he's like, yeah, I kind of liked it actually.
Humans are such a mess. Humans are like the most interesting species, like just on a mental level. We're all so fucked and so hard to understand and comprehend. Like there's no rhyme or reason to sometimes the way we think.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, of course, like I felt special because I could get to him, right? Like other people couldn't.
Sure.
You know, he kept people at an arm's length most of the time. He still does. So the fact that I could like get somewhere wedged in his brain, you know, I kind of enjoyed that.
You felt like you're kind of cracking the walnut or something. And then
yes.
Once in a while you get like, oh wow, I got something juicy here. Like, this is awesome. Like,
exactly. Yeah.
Right. Huh. So, you know, you know him on a personal level. I guess tell me a little bit about that. What do you genuinely believe, you know, some people say he has, like, I don't know, was it autism or whatever, or some sort of like mental issues. What is he actually like in, you know, as a person?
So he's kind of flaky, which is not a positive quality.
Sure. I like my women flaky. That's for sure.
But no, I mean, people have called him autistic. They've called him lots of things, called him manic depressive, called him sociopathic.
That's what the documentary suggests as well, right? Because they'd had a doctor apparently like look at him and diagnose him.
People have diagnosed me from like television and
true.
Like, that's the stupidest thing.
You're
like,
right. You're right.
Come, no one should listen to that crap.
Right? You're right. You're right. I'm just saying, I'm being like the devil's advocate here, I guess. I agree 100%.
But so he does have a batch of things, a lot of disorders. He is, at least according to like what the defense lawyer's psychiatrist found, like he is like schizoid disorder and definitely like severe anxiety disorder, probably mixed with some depression. What else? He claims he's not manic depressive, but if you get to know him, the first thing you will think is this person is manic depressive.
what are the traits of a manic depressive person?
Well, you know, like when people can be very, very like manic and up and like they take stupid risks and they like get very like self-aggrandizing. Like he does all those things. Their emotions like are kind of worn on the outside in a sense. Like, you know, they can make everybody else feel the way they feel.
I gotcha. Yeah,
and he
gotcha.
Can do all those things. So that's one issue. So I know I still kind of have a penciled in check mark in my head of maybe manic depression. Allegedly no. Allegedly he's not autistic. Okay. Although he does seem to have, it might be the schizoid disorder that like makes it hard for him to connect with people all the way. He connects with people on a superficial level pretty easily. But like I said,
on an emotional level, he struggles with
very much. He hates it. In fact, that's probably why, after connecting with me and I decided to do a profile on Al, he was very unhappy, but, so it goes.
What does he think about your writing and the stuff that you're currently doing? Have you had a conversation with him about any of it?
We chatted a little bit. He has been generally very supportive, especially considering that I am writing about him, about all this personal stuff, which not everybody loves. He has, when he did have an alt account on Twitter that people knew of, it's been shut down. He did retweet it a few times, so retweeted a few posts. So that was very nice. I know he reads it at least occasionally. So there's that.
It's funny from, I mean, I'm thinking about it from his perspective. It's kind of funny. Like his ex-girlfriend is writing these super long, deep, personal things about him. It's like, I think I'd want to read that. Like, it'd be very hard for me to ignore that.
Yeah. I mean, I've been kind of waiting to get into the really personal stuff, but it's going to come eventually. I mean, and I've told him that what I'm going to do is at least try to put, weave context into it, make sure it's not just like, oh, here's some, you know, crazy crap that he told me. I won't do that. But yeah, I think as a guy or as anybody in a relationship who has been in a relationship, it's probably quite difficult to deal with a partner or an ex-partner who's writing a book about you, but he's been very cool about it.
Right. I guess that's the upside of that, like emotion, like not being emotionally, maybe someone that was a little more emotional would be much more upset about this stuff.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah. My ex-husband is never happy when I make friends.
Well, that's good. So how has life been like for him? You know, he's out of prison, right? He's on house arrest or what?
I think he just got off of house arrest. I am not, he's kind of been quiet since getting off of house arrest. I don't know if he's just like got a lot of women lined up that he's fucking or what, but.
He's streaming every day. He's still streaming. He's not quiet.
Okay, all right. I don't watch the streams because I don't want it to affect what I'm writing.
No one should watch the stream with all due respect. With all due respect, those streams are horrendous. I am mind boggled by the amount of people watching him eat Cheerios at his computer and sell stocks.
No, I'm not doing that.
Like 6 hours. It's not like, oh, you know, it's like an hour. No, it's like your day.
If that's what he wants to do, that's what he wants to do.
Is there a part of you that's kind of like, since a lot of these things are in the past, and yes, of course, this is a significant story to you, but there's also, you know, there's a part of the story where, you know, this is your former lover. It's like, what happens after this? Are you in any way interested in like reconciling, or is this something that you want to get out of the way? And then this is a thing in your past that you can move forward with now. How are you looking at the story kind of in the long run?
I do think that it is a way I can sort of reconcile with things and kind of move on. For me, it's actually been really great for that. In my case, like I've been able to just like see things from a like more of a like a 30,000 foot view.
But that's what writing does. That's why writing is good journaling, right? That gives you a little bit of a step back and let's look at this thing kind of
exactly.
perspective.
Exactly. I mean, like at the time and the place and when Martin was in it and I was in it, you know, it seemed like there was a lot of possibility there for a relationship and what we could do with each other. But if it's not there, it's not there, right? Like if two parties aren't in it, there's no point in trying to force anything. That's ridiculous. So, you know, just got to go our separate ways.
Do you look at yourself in those days like a different person than what you are, let's say, today?
Not really. I think I was just, you know, it was on the path. I mean, I had probably more oxytocin like floating around in my brain, but
okay.
But, you know, like it was.
Well, I asked this, you know, it's a normal thing. You look back at a past relationship and you look at where you were in your life and you say, well, yeah, that's who I was at that time. And today I'm this other thing. Or maybe that's not the case. So I'm curious kind of like where you feel you're at in your life.
I think that the relationship, I look back at myself when I was married previously and I think those things like that was a different person.
Okay.
And then it was like when I was sort of dating Martin, it was like a bridge to like where I am now.
Interesting. Okay.
Like it kind of helped get me there essentially.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Because now, you know, I'm a writer. Like the way I write now is so much different than what it used to be. And I'm so much more confident in it. And I don't think I could have written this way, you know, if I hadn't gone through this experience.
Right. And no one wants to buy this book. Like no publisher wants to not touching this with a 100-foot pole. Your best work, your most interesting story, a story that literally writes itself. It's full of mysterious characters and side stories. There's so many rabbit holes you can go down and not a soul wants to touch it.
Well, I haven't tried since putting it out as a Substack. We're going to try again. I have a new agent who's looking into it.
Yeah.
And there's been like a movie slowly in development. I don't know. Or
really?
Thing. Yeah, I can't talk a whole lot about it because it's like not really, I mean, they bought the rights, but yeah, there might be a thing.
Not like a documentary, an actual movie about him. Like someone
actual
plays
movie,
him.
Yeah. Like,
oh, that's going to be hilarious. I can't wait for that.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens with that. But yeah, when I first tried to sell the book, it was a different book. So I kind of understand, actually, I think a little bit about what the reaction was that I didn't get at the time, which was, you know, I hadn't fully realized like where I was in the story and what the story really was. You know, like I was trying to write a book about Martin and that wasn't going to work.
You didn't let it settle, essentially.
No, now the story has evolved into something that's very different. And like you said, it's more interesting because there's characters and there's drama.
There's so much now. I mean, yeah, you have so much to draw from.
Right, right. So we'll see what happens if that changes the picture.
It's really fascinating that like, do you still blame a little bit of cancel culture for it being so difficult to get this thing more eyes on it?
Yeah, I've read tons of terrible books that I know, you know, and I know what I, at least even the first version of my book proposal was better then. So
really?
Yeah. Cool. I mean, like, yeah. I mean, there's definitely, I know, like, there's an element of that. Book publishing is kind of a small club.
What did you think about the movie, the documentary? Because that got absolutely destroyed on IMDb, and I don't understand why, unless it's just that no one watched it and they just fucking dislike.
I mean, people will go out of their way to click dislike on things about Martin. So
but it's like 7 years ago. Like the movie came out last year. Like how the fuck did they even usually cancel culture doesn't last this long.
that's another aspect of it being so interesting.
This is the longest I feel like anyone's been canceled. Like, I can't go on a dating app.
You can't go on a dating app. I know. It's wild. It's just absolutely insane. Yeah. I mean, I thought the documentary is okay. I think Brent did the best job he could have with what he had. It certainly was a challenge because he didn't get Martin, right? So that was, that would have probably made it better. It's not as compelling, even though, you know, I'm talking to Brent, like, and I was in the documentary. There's only so much I can, you know,
tell him.
Right.
Secondary source.
Yeah. But there is another documentary potentially in the works. Actually, one of Martin's friends has been a filmmaker for some time. So he actually got footage of Martin coming out of prison. And he talked to Martin. And he talked to Martin and me when we met for the first time after he was out of prison. So there might be something better coming out.
It's a fascinating story. There's so many layers to the onion. I just wanted to kind of talk about random things, maybe bring some more light to some of your work. I'll leave all your links down below to your Substack. I'm a subscriber, so I'll definitely be reading it going forward. Is there anything else you want to plug, talk about?
Well, I don't know if it's really, I have been trying to get a nonprofit going. It's actually an idea that Martin and I came up with, that I've kind of tried to run with. It's called, monadnockvalleygroup.org. It's a little bit of a strange
name. It's a great name. I think that's going to catch on. I think
that... you can hate me for this, but it's actually a very obscure Ayn Rand reference.
Okay. All right. Sure. Hey, I've heard weirder names, but not many.
It's actually, it's meant to help formerly incarcerated people start small businesses. So we have
Beautiful.
Some people that Martin met in prison. I'd like to expand it to more and to be able to help them with their business ideas, getting some things off the ground. So, yeah.
Do you have a link for that? You can send me a link.
Yeah, or... I'll send you a link. It's just, I'll send you a link, but it's just monadnockvalleygroup.org.
Yeah, I'm going to need that link. I need that link.
The link. That's great SEO because there aren't any others.
But yeah. Okay, awesome. Well, thank you for your time. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I'm looking forward to your future work.
Thanks so much.